Good evening, everyone. I'm David Kelly. I'm the director of the Institute. I'd like to welcome you to the Institute Forum, our New York lecture series. The purpose of this forum is to provide an opportunity for the exchange of ideas on topics relevant to objectivism, and that will certainly be the case tonight. When I'm trying to describe Ayn Rand's philosophy to intellectuals who are not familiar with it, I often begin by saying that she was the last of the Enlightenment thinkers. When I'm feeling feisty, I add, or the first of their return. We associate the Enlightenment with the urbane tolerance of Voltaire, the can-do optimism of Ben Franklin, the soaring phrases of the Declaration of Independence. As a cultural symbol, the Enlightenment stands for reason, for individualism, for progress, and the perfectibility of man. Objectivists have always felt a special affinity for this age. Its values are ours, and so are its enemies. Conservatives have always attacked the Enlightenment for exalting reason over faith and tradition, and for denying man's fallen nature. The cultural left, on the other hand, has no objection to human perfectibility. It's been trying to perfect man out of existence for over a century. But it attacks Enlightenment individualism in the name of communal solidarity. When we look past the symbol to the age itself, however, the Enlightenment is a more elusive target. The leading philosophers of the age included David Hume and Immanuel Kant, who were certainly no friends of reason. It included Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was one of the founders of modern collectivism. What was the Enlightenment in fact? What was its view of reason, and how did it evolve? Our guide to these questions is Professor George Walsh, whom I'm very happy to be introducing. George is a good friend and a trustee of the Institute. He earned a doctorate in philosophy from Princeton University in 1952. By that time, he was already teaching at Hobart College in New York State, and he stayed there for 20 years, rising to the rank of full professor. In 1968, he moved to Eisenhower College, and then 10 years later to Salisbury State University in Maryland, from which he recently retired. Along the way, among other writings, he published a translation of an important German work, Alfred Schütz's Phenomenology of the Social World. You know, the philosophy profession has a publication that lists job offerings by all academic departments in the country. When George retired, I remember noticing the ad from Salisbury for someone to take his place. I was daunted by the job description, the range of courses that some poor guy was going to have to cover. George is a scholar of truly amazing erudition, and his knowledge of the history of philosophy and religion is particularly encyclopedic. Before I met him, a mutual friend, who was himself a scholar of the first rank, said to me, "You know, George has read the collected works of philosophers I've never even heard of." George became interested in objectivism in the 1960s. Unlike most intellectuals in the movement, he was already an experienced professional philosopher when he first encountered Ayn Rand's ideas, at a stage in his career when most philosophers rarely change their minds about anything important. And indeed, George told me that he was not convinced by his first reading of Atlas Shrugged, but he went through it a second time and diagrammed the whole argument of the book. That must be somewhat diagrammed, George. He wrote an insightful article on Herbert Marcuse for Ayn Rand's Journal of the Objectivist, and he's been one of the most popular speakers at objectivist conferences. His lectures on Rousseau, on Marx, and on the history of religion are fascinating works of intellectual history. Following tonight's talk, we'll have a question period, and then we'll break for food and festivities. So without further ado, let's begin. Please welcome Professor George Walsh.
Thank you, David. There's absolutely no way for me to live up to that introduction, or was it a setup? Ladies and gentlemen, in 1687, a massive scientific treatise was published in London, a treatise which for the first time set forth and proved a set of general laws of motion. Which laws could explain both the movements of falling bodies and the movements of the planet around the sun? The title of the treatise was The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, and its author was Isaac Newton. In 1804, 117 years later, an old man was solemnly laid to rest in the crypt of the Cathedral of Königsberg, East Prussia. An old man who was also the author of massive treatises. Over the tomb of the old man was placed the epitaph, "The starry heavens above me, the moral law within me." The name of the old man was Immanuel Kant. These two dates may conveniently be used to enclose a vast intellectual and cultural movement that changed the face of Western civilization. That movement was the Enlightenment. These two men respectively opened and closed the movement with the ideas they set forth in their manner of arguing for them. Newton perhaps did not even realize that he was inaugurating any such movement. Yet, paradoxically, he was its creator. Kant popularized the name Aufklärung, enlightenment, proudly counted himself a supporter of the movement, but paradoxically, he was the one who drove the bus off the road. In this lecture, I am not going to be concerned with this act of destruction, whether it was voluntary or unintended, but with the movement itself, its strengths, the weaknesses which led to its disintegration, and the hope of, if any, of reviving it. In each of the points of reference, I have chosen to mark the beginning and the end of the Enlightenment. There is an express reference to the heavenly body. In each case, the concern is with the lawfulness and regularity of the movement of these heavenly bodies. A matter of awe to each of the two men. As a matter of fact, Kant's interest in the planets was hardly less than Newton, for in 1755, at the age of 31, he published his General History and Theory of the Heavens, what later came to be known as the Kant-Laplace, or nebular theory of the origin of our solar system. What is the significance for our understanding of the Enlightenment, of this profound preoccupation with the movements of the heavenly bodies, their lawfulness, their regularity? After all, there's a great deal more to the Enlightenment than astronomy or physics. The Enlightenment involved a whole new world outlook, including a new picture of man, his nature, his values, and his rights, a whole new view of knowledge, of history, of society, of state, of law, a reorientation in aesthetic value, a new attitude toward manners and civilized behavior, a more humane attitude in human relations, culminating in the outlawing of slavery and torture and in the emancipation of the Jews. The importance of the theory of the heavens lay precisely in this. What Kant, in his essay, The Answer to the Question, What is Enlightenment, 1784, called the emancipation of man from superstition and tutelage, or wardship. By superstition, Kant meant the expectation that nature would be full of miracles and incomprehensible events. And by tutelage, or wardship, he meant the subordination of reason to the authority of the church, state, or tradition. Under these headings of superstition and tutelage were being challenged the medieval metaphysics of a universe arranged like a household, presided over by an absent parent who communicated with us, his children, through an infallible babysitter or a stack of infallible notes. And a medieval epistemology, just believe you are too young to understand. A new world picture was being substituted. In place of superstition was a lawful cosmos. In place of tutelage was reason, a reason capable of understanding the cosmos. This cosmos and this reason was the Newtonian achievement which made possible the Enlightenment. All reservations about Kant's other views aside, we may rejoice in this concise statement, but we may well be inclined to ask, why was Newton necessary? Why didn't the same thing happen in the Renaissance? For purposes of clarity, we must distinguish between the Renaissance, the Age of Reason, and the Enlightenment, although they overlap. The Renaissance occurred in the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries and consisted of a great revival of learning and revival of the classical Greek attitude toward man. Its focus was on this world and the individual. The term Age of Reason is now used more and more to cover both the 17th and 18th centuries. The term Enlightenment to cover the 18th century alone. The defining mark of the Age of Reason was precisely respect for and glorification of reason. The first part of the Age of the Enlightenment, the 17th century, produced both isolated but real scientific achievements and vast systems of metaphysics and physics for which grandiose claims were made. The Enlightenment was based on a proven scientific world picture and was a movement among the educated classes of Europe, a movement which consisted in their conversion to the Newtonian picture and their attempts to find within it the place of man and his value. Why then didn't the Enlightenment come sooner, emerging from the work of Copernicus and Galileo? The truth is that the educated classes were as yet unconvinced. Copernicus's system fell short of demonstration. Galileo's laws of falling bodies, although demonstrated, fell short of being a complete world system. Kepler's laws of planetary motion, in turn, fell short of application to all bodies. Taking into account these uncertainties and taking into account the opposition of the authorities, including the ever-present Inquisition, it's no wonder that so many judicious men hesitated, caught between the new and the old. Another factor intervened. To fill the gap caused by the lack of demonstration and the lack of completeness so far shown in the work of the scientists, a new group of thinkers appeared, the rationalists. These men put forth elaborate deductive systems which claimed to have solved all problems, at least in principle. They gradually took off from some sense observations, made almost immediate appeal to clear and distinct ideas, taking mathematics as their ideal of clarity. And they declared their systems complete, but their ambition far exceeded their success. As a matter of fact, they failed miserably to substantiate their claim. To show the uniqueness of the Enlightenment, we must show why the rationalists failed. In spite of their use of sense observation, in spite of their clear and distinct ideas, in spite of their mathematical measurement, in spite of the architectonic completeness of their system. To do this, we need only look for a few minutes at the methods and results of Descartes, the author of the most widely accepted system of natural philosophy, in other words, physics, before the time of Newton. As for his methods, I quote from his earliest work, The Rules for the Direction of the Mind, written before 1530. Quote, as regards any subject we propose to investigate, our inquiries should be directed at that of which we can have a clear and distinct intuition, or to that which we can deduce with certainty. By intuition, I mean not the changing evidence of the senses, but the indubitable concept formed by an unclouded and attentive mind, a conception that originates solely from the light of reason and is more certain than deduction itself, unquote. Now, what are some examples of intuition? Each individual can see by intuition that he exists and that he thinks, and that the triangle is bounded by three lines only, the sphere bounded by a single surface. There are far more numerous facts of this kind, Descartes tells us, than most people think, unquote. What is deduction? Here I paraphrase. A deduction is an argument consisting of a chain of premises serving as links, each one of which links is known by a clear intuition, even though we do not see the whole chain with a single glance. Deduction differs from intuition in that, one, it involves a movement of the mind, and two, that although certain, is not self-evident. Instead, it borrows its certainty from memory. Therefore, it is a separate mode of knowledge in addition to intuition. Besides intuition and deduction, quote, there is no other way of acquiring knowledge, unquote. In these brief statements, we have the rationalist method in a nutshell and with a vengeance. From this basis, Descartes went on to intuit and deduce a whole system of philosophy, which included physics. Among the basic premises of the system are the following: that substance is a thing which exists without needing any other thing in order to exist, that there is always one principal attribute of substance which constitutes its nature or essence and on which all others depend, that extension in length, breadth, and depth constitute that attribute, since every other property of body presupposes extension. For instance, we cannot conceive figure but as an extended thing, nor motion except in an extended space. On the other hand, we can conceive extension without figure or motion, quote, as is quite clear to anyone who attends to the matter, unquote. From these premises, Descartes goes on to account for every perceived property of matter in terms of extension alone, as studied by analytic geometry, of which he was the inventor, and which by definition has as its proper subject matter extension. Motion, he says, is a non-essential property of matter, therefore God must have added it arbitrarily. Heat, gravitation, and solidity, he explains solely in terms of matter in motion. There is no concept of force or of action at a distance, no concept of man. All is explained in terms of extended bodies mechanically communicating motion to each other by immediate contact. What appears to be hardness is merely a subjective sensation caused by the fact that our hand is traveling faster than the object it hit. What appears to be gravitation is explained by the fact that all bodies are arranged in whirlpools or vortices. Within these vortices, the larger and lower particles are pushed by the smaller and faster ones toward the center, where they form the earth, the planets, and the stars. Why is all matter arranged in vortices? Because all motion is circular. Why is all motion circular? Because there's no empty space, and something must move out before anything can move in, as in real estate. Why is there no empty space? Because the essence of matter is extension. So wherever there is extension, there is matter. One cannot have an essential attribute of a substance present without having the substance itself present. Furthermore, it is, quote, absolutely inconceivable that pure nothing should have extension, and a void or vacuum is pure nothing. From these abstract premises, Descartes deduces about 300 concrete conclusions, such as why tides ascend for 6 1/5 hours and descend for 6 1/5 hours. Why metals are especially found at the roots of mountains toward the south and east. Why glass is liquid when it is white hot. Why it is brittle when cold. Why the flame of a candle is pointed, and why it gives off smoke. At the end of the treatise, which is called, by the way, The Principles of Philosophy, he announces with satisfaction, quote, "And thus by a simple enumeration, it may be deduced that there is no phenomenon in nature that has not been dealt with by the explanations given in this treatise," unquote. All has been explained in terms of motion, magnitude, and figure by reference to, quote, "the first and most simple principles of human knowledge," unquote. This was the method of rationalism. What was wrong with it? It was not that it had no basis in sensory observation. Descartes, looking at his famous piece of wax, noted that it could take on many shapes, but was always extended. Seems to be a sensory observation. His mistake lay in his arbitrary assumption that matter had only one intrinsic essential attribute, extension, and hence that all other properties of matter, such as the phenomena of gravitation, must be explained in terms of that one property. Hence he had to introduce a special hypothesis in order to make gravitation a function of the shape and size of objects, specifically the hypothesis that the larger and slower bodies are pushed towards the center of whirlpools by smaller and faster bodies. But the hypothesis about the different sized bodies was merely a deus ex machina, which in itself made no further prediction and hence could not be tested. It was, however, immensely satisfying to Descartes because it saved the place of extension as the essential attribute of matter. After all, extension was a clear and distinct idea which was diaphanously open to the searchlight of analytic geometry, which in turn had been invented by Descartes precisely to study, you guessed it, extension. QED. Anything in nature, anything that happened, could in this way be hammered into the suitcase of the system, provided that Descartes kept jumping up and down on top of it, shouting equations of analytic geometry. This is the sort of thing that Voltaire satirized in Candide when he spoke of Dr. Pangloss, or Dr. Explain Everything, the professor of metaphysical, theological, cosmologo, noodleology, and who claimed that it was obvious why why human beings had noses. Anyone know? To hold your glasses up, yes. It was precisely this attitude which was to be condemned by one of the major voices of the Enlightenment. D'Alembert, in his preliminary discourse to the French Encyclopedia, called the rationalist attitude the spirit of system, l'esprit de système, which was opposed, he said, to the systematic spirit, l'esprit systématique, which, he said, was exemplified by dear Newton, and which was the spirit of the Enlightenment. What Newton had given to man was a system of natural philosophy that was based on observation, mathematically demonstrated, which was open to all to check, correct, and advance. The great treatise, the Principia of Newton, was an exact quantitative description of the motions of all visible bodies. This description, I had to go into a little bit of detail in order to give you the picture of the immense task which Newton completed. This description was stated in terms of laws which subsumed the previous laws of Galileo and Kepler in one vast system. Nothing like this had ever been known before. There were the three laws of motion. First, that a body continues in a state of rest or of uniform motion in a straight line unless it is compelled to change that state by forces impressed upon it. Second, that the change of motion is proportional to the force impressed. Third, that to every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. The application of these laws to circular motion results in a formula fixing the amount of centripetal force necessary to deflect a body from its straight line path into a circle. By fitting this formula into Kepler's third law, which relates the planet's mean distance from the sun to the time it takes to complete its elliptical orbit, Newton deduces that the centripetal force holding the planets in their orbits around the sun must decrease with the square of the planet's distance from the sun. Then checking, he found that this law applies to the orbits around Jupiter of its satellite and the orbit of the moon around the Earth. Earth. He then correlated the moon's orbit with the acceleration of falling bodies on the surface of the Earth as measured by Galileo, and concluded that in all these four cases, a single law is operative, to which he implied the ancient Latin, to which he applied the ancient Latin term gravitas, literally heaviness, and finally formulated the law of universal gravitation, which states in modern terms now that every particle of matter in the universe attracts every other particle with a force varying directly as the product of their masses and inversely as the square of the distance between them. A little more complicated than the story of the apple. This law was then confirmed from the orbits of the comets and the behavior of tides. This was the systematic spirit which D'Alembert praised as the spirit of the Enlightenment. It was not only Newton's finishism that was important in igniting the Enlightenment, it was how he arrived at that. It was his philosophy of science. Nowhere is this laid down more clearly than in his Rules of Reasoning and Philosophy in Book 3 of the Principia. You will remember how Descartes had started with a piece of wax, with its color, shape, size, odor, taste, and so on, as perceived by the senses. Descartes denied that any true judgment could be made of the wax, not even that it was a single body, on the basis of sense perception alone. Quote Descartes now, "Bodies are not, strictly speaking, perceived by the senses at all, but only by the intellect." Unquote. And it was the intellect alone which grasped the fact that the wax was a piece of matter whose essence was extension. Apart from intuition and deduction, there is no other way of acquiring knowledge. So much for the senses. Well, Newton had an entirely different message in his Rule 3. Quote, "For since the qualities of bodies are only known to us by experiment, we are to treat as universally present in all bodies such qualities as universally agree with experiment. We in no other way know the extension of bodies than by our senses, nor can our senses perceive it in all bodies, such as microscopic ones. But since we perceive extension in all that we perceive by the senses, we ascribe it universally to all others also. That many bodies are hard, we learn by experience, and because the hardness of the whole arises from the hardness of the parts, we therefore justly infer the hardness of the undivided particle. That all bodies are impenetrable, we gather not from reason, but from sensation. That all bodies have inertia, we infer from the bodies we have seen." Quote from Newton, "And this is the foundation of all philosophy." Unquote. How totally different an attitude from that of Descartes. Newton was thus what we call an empiricist. But more than that, he was an experimentalist. In his Optics, he describes his method as proceeding by what he calls analysis and synthesis. Roughly, analysis is induction and synthesis. He says, "Analysis consists in making experiments and observations and in drawing general conclusions from them by induction. By this way of analysis, we may proceed from the effects to their causes and from particular causes to the most general one, till the argument ends in the most general laws. This is the method of analysis. Synthesis consists in assuming the causes discovered and established as principles and by these laws explaining the phenomena proceeding from them and then proving the explanation," unquote. The laws discovered by Newton were expressed in mathematical terms, but in no way did he believe it possible to reduce physics to mathematics. He constantly called for physical explanation, verified by physical experiments. His was not a system of mathematics, but a system of nature set forth in mathematically expressed principle. Everything was based on analysis of concrete, but the system was not closed, because the analysis knew only provisional stopping points instead of absolute stopping points like those of Descartes. Descartes stopped dead at extension and used that attribute and its modes to explain the whole physical universe. Newton refused to do this. He used the term hypothesis, as a matter of fact, to refer to such principles as those of Descartes, that the essence of matter is extension, whose varieties account for all natural events. He used the word hypothesis to refer to the theory that gravitation is to be explained by mechanical contact and so on. He writes, quote, "I have not yet been able to infer the reasons for the properties of gravity from phenomena, and I known fingo hypothesis, I do not feign hypotheses." For whatever is not inferred from phenomena, I call a hypothesis. And I do not follow hypotheses, whether metaphysical or physical, whether of occult qualities or mechanical. It is enough that gravity should really exist and act according to the laws expounded by us and should suffice for all the motions of the celestial bodies and the seas, unquote. This explanation was given in 1712. The Principia was probably the greatest treatise on science ever written. It solved every remaining discrepancy to date of physical and astronomical theory. Many future discoveries were to be made on the basis of its law. In content and in methodology, it stood at the foundation of the Industrial Revolution. The work of Newton was received with the greatest acclaim by his countrymen. The poet Alexander Pope proclaimed, quote, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light," unquote. Edmund Halley, the discoverer of the comet, declared that by discovering the laws of nature, Newton had presented to humanity a gift greater than that of the greatest of legislators, greater than that of the first founders of cities, greater than that of the inventor of agriculture, greater than that of the inventor of music. At the sudden bursting in the sky of the intellectual nova, which was Newton, up to the French, who were up to then proud of their Baroque rationalism and their great culture hero Descartes, passed into a state of profound culture shock. Fontenelle in 1727 declared that Newton had, quote, "destroyed the vortices of Descartes and overturned the immense celestial edifice which we had thought impregnable," unquote. French rationalistic culture experienced a kind of hemorrhage as more and more of the educated class took up the study of Newton. There were non-mathematical expositions of Newton, even a book called Newton for the Lady. But it was Voltaire who spread the word to the educated classes of all of Europe. In his Letters on the English, written from England, he outlined Newton's world system and philosophy of science and asserted that Newton was greater than any political or military history, political or military hero would ever appear. Quoting now from Voltaire, quote, "True greatness consists in using a powerful understanding to enlighten oneself and others. It is to him who masters our mind by the force of truth, not to those who enslave men by violence. It is to him who understands the world, not to those who disfigure it, that we owe our reverence," unquote. He had attended Newton's funeral and had noted with amazement the solemn assembly of figures prominent in government as well as in science and the respect with which the Anglican clergy welcomed the body to Westminster Abbey. Such is the power of ideas. Returning to France, Voltaire published in 1734 his popular Elements of the Philosophy of Newton, wherein he expounded with great clarity Newton's optics and the law of gravitation. Soon Newton's reputation spread from France to other European countries and, of course, from England, Scotland, and America. But it was not only his reputation, it was his system and the methodology which supported it. 3 years after the publication of the Principia in 1690, taught at Cambridge, Edinburgh, St. Andrews, and shortly thereafter at Leiden. What had Newton given to man? Not the mere philosophical assertion that man lives in an intelligible universe, but the living, concrete picture of a rational individual discovering the laws of the universe and demonstrating them to his fellow men. This living, concrete picture was itself profoundly convincing. It produced conversion and commitment to the idea of a rational universe. As this conversion and commitment spread to more and more people, it became a movement, adherence to which distinguished one as enlightened, and ignorance or denial of which marked one as superstitious or intellectually reactionary. Thus, we have the inauguration of a cultural movement which was not confined to a few creative individuals, as was the Renaissance, nor was it a sect or cult. It spread among the educated classes, however numerous and members of these classes were in different countries. There was one in Russia, Catherine the Great. It eventually produced... It eventually produced a new overall point of view and accompanying sense of life, a point of view that could only be described as optimistic and happiness-oriented, a sense of life that could only be described as joyful and benevolent. But the Newtonian picture of the universe by itself could by itself have never produced this new world outlook nor this new sense of life. Considered by itself, the Newtonian universe was the universe pictured as a vast machine. It was used as the premise premise for a number of different philosophical conclusions, which could hardly qualify for the name enlightenment. It buttressed and indeed strengthened the teleological argument for the existence of the deity. After all, a watch needs a watchmaker. It was used as an argument for determinism and against free will. It was used as an argument for materialism and against the efficacy of consciousness. And some of Newton's self-appointed disciples in France explained that consciousness was secreted by the brain as the liver secretes bile. This Newtonian system was used as an argument for psychological egoism, psychological hedonism, and then worked up into the paradox of how one can reconcile these positions with morality, meaning the Judeo-Christian code. So a movement of secular altruism was gradually generated, a movement that taught that men had to be forced to be good. Who could force them except a state ruled by a new secular priesthood of bureaucrats and social workers? Granted the Newtonian world picture in isolation, it was obvious that all deuces were wild. Its adherents could be anyone from enlightened despots like Catherine the Great, Frederick the Great, to the Marquis de Sade, whose philosophy of the bedroom I commend to you as a textbook of Newtonian applied science. No, to understand the real spirit of the Enlightenment with a joyous sense of life, we must go beyond the Newtonian world picture and the Newtonian method. We must identify and appreciate the new philosophy of man, which emerged at the same time. We have already said that Newton made the universe hospitable to man by making it intelligible to him. But what of the being that needed this hospitality, that needed this intelligibility? What about man himself? There must have been a new understanding of man emerging at this time in order to produce the enlightenment that we know. After all, to have a Newtonian universe inhibited by a creature of original sin, or a creature whose life was a perpetual seesaw of irrational impulses, would be to have a nightmare world. What was needed was a revival and renovation of the Aristotelian view of man as the rational animal seeking his own fulfillment and happiness. This revival, this renovation, did happen, and it was provided by a number of thinkers, the chief of which was John Locke, the friend of Newton. Locke was convinced that Newton had answered the basic question of what is the nature of physical reality, and that Newton had given a satisfactory and rough account of how we come to proper conclusions in science. But he sought to add to Newton's work a complete epistemology, an account of how we come to have any knowledge at all. Locke also sought to give an account of the origin and validation of moral judgment, and finally to set forth a rational political philosophy. Locke's work came to fruition in a fairly complete system of philosophy whose major components came off the press together in the year 1690, the Essay Concerning the Human Understanding and the Second Treatise of Government. These two major works of Locke, when added to the major works of Newton, are in effect a general description of the universe and man, in other words, a basic world outlook. What Locke provided was, first of all, a thoroughgoing refutation of the theory of innate ideas, so dear to the rational. This refutation was, of course, in thorough agreement with and provided the groundwork for Newton's inductive experimentalist philosophy of science. Locke went on to provide a positive empiricist epistemology, and giving in detail an account of how, starting with certain simple data of sense experience and introspection, we abstract general ideas and build up the whole structure of knowledge. In this, as in other areas of philosophy, Locke was an eloquent but not an elegant thinker. He had a strong tendency to eclecticism, and he combined elements of Aristotle with other elements drawn from Descartes and yet others drawn from the nominalist. His main divergences from Aristotle were probably not obvious to the average educated reader, and this is a good thing, for it made possible a little breathing space for a revival of the Aristotelian spirit in epistemology. Within a very short time thereafter, Locke's inconsistencies were spotted and mercilessly attacked by other empiricist philosophers who tried to resolve the inconsistencies by simply eliminating the Aristotelian element in Locke. So far as his epistemology is concerned, we may conclude that Locke provided an eloquent defense of a rough-hewn empiricism, which was effective until a failure to think things through radically became all too painfully obvious.
To continue, please turn your tape over now.
Starting out with the assertion that a completely logical system of ethics could be provided, he tried to carry this suggestion out only to to a very slight extent. He did say, in effect, that values can be deduced from facts, and gave, as an example, that from the study of the logical properties of murder or theft, their wrongness could be demonstrated. But then he abandoned this fruitful line of thought and started a systematic ethics that, and stated that a systematic ethics was not necessary, since we all know what right and wrong are. Right and wrong had two foundations, one in pleasure and pain, and one in divine revelation. A man's senses and the experiences of pleasure and pain, what he should pursue or avoid, and calls these good and bad. He learns eventually to prefer long-range to short-range pleasures. Locke was a little optimistic on this one. He learns eventually to prefer long-range to short-range pleasures, and regards these as better or right. An example is the pleasure of having a good reputation or being honest. Generally, Locke is a hedonistic egoist in this part of his theory. But he then announces that pleasure or happiness is better if it accrues to a larger number of people, and that we should be unselfish in the distribution of happiness. Now, God agrees with this. And he has personally set up a system of commandments geared to rewards and punishments in the next life, which, once revealed, are sufficient to make rational men selfishly motivated to pursue eternal felicity for themselves by doing good unto others. It is safe to say that this part of Locke's contribution was a philosophical blowout. Locke's political philosophy was anything but a blowout. He made the first even partially successful attempt to establish a theory of rights, making the individual its focus. Basing his argument on the idea of natural law, deriving ultimately from the Stoics and coming to him through the Anglican thinker Hooker, Locke made the autonomy of the individual the central concern of this theory. According to Locke, the human individual can see by the light of reason that his primary goal and responsibility should be self-preservation. He can see by the light of reason that the end of self-preservation is to be found by the use of his reason in productivity and in trade. Because these are necessities for self-preservation, they are rationally demonstrated rights. They would be rights in a state of nature, that is, a condition in which there was no government, and they would be respected and executed by rational men. However, there are irrational men around, and besides, even rational men can fall into error. Therefore, an impartial judge is needed to define and execute the law. This is government, and it must be arrived at by free consent of the governed. The sole purpose of government is to protect the rights of life, liberty, and property, and any government which systematically violates these rights may rightly be overthrown. This theory of rights was the most enduring part of Locke's system and was the greatest political achievement of the Enlightenment. It influenced the laws and constitutions of many countries, and of course our own country was its foremost beneficiary. The United States of America, both in its institutions and in its sense of life, may be called the country of John Locke. The attention I have given to Newton and Locke as the two great stars of the Enlightenment should not be allowed to obscure the fact that in England and France and Scotland and Italy and Holland, Germany, and of course in America, there were brilliant major lights in every field of endeavor, in every sphere of life, turning out essays and journals and whole encyclopedias, working in laboratories and observatories, painting and composing music, poring over fossils, classifying plants, presiding over salons and over courts of justice, advocating and planning prison reform, drafting legislation and arguing in assemblies, arguing for free will and human dignity against Calvinists and other determinists, as did Jonathan Mayhew of Boston. Nor should we neglect the ordinary unsung soldier of the cause, the hard-working businessman, the provincial physician or pharmacist working amid a sea of superstition, the role of the Order of Freemasons, with all its degrees and secret clasps, ought not to be forgotten, for it was the Order of the Enlightenment. Voltaire and Ben Franklin belong to the same lodge, the Lodge of the Three Sisters. The antipathy of the church toward the Masons may be understood in large part in this light. Imagine the terror of the ecclesiastical authorities in France when a lodge was discovered in one of the strictest monasteries. I forget which. I think it's the Carmelites. The enlightened citizen soon found himself a member of an emerging new aristocracy. The aristocracy of the informed and judicious. The aristocracy of the men of good sense. He could easily join in the ridicule which Richard Steele aimed at the code of values of the old aristocracy, as expressed, for instance, in the following satirical letter in the Spectator of June 7th, 1709. Quote, "Sir, your extraordinary behavior last night and the liberty you were pleased to take with me leads me this morning to tell you that, because you are an ill-bred puppy, I will meet you in Hyde Park an hour since. I desire you to come with a pistol in your hand and endeavor to shoot me through the head to teach you some manners." It was chiefly this sort of enlightened citizen who filled the coffee houses of London, the town meetings of Vermont, who prided himself on his common sense and openness to argument. It was chiefly this sort of man who aspired to be, in his own town of whatever size, the 18th century equivalent of a citizen of the ancient Roman Republic. This sort of man who inspired the revival of classical architecture, which can still be seen in the public buildings and monuments still facing the greens of many an American town. It was chiefly this sort of man who took his place among the founders of the new nation and the drafters of its laws. This positive aspect of the Enlightenment was soon to become clouded over. There were ominous internal strains caused by the inconsistent premises held by its adherents. We have already noted some of these in Locke. The Enlightenment was not a consistent philosophy. It was a movement of men of common sympathies and, to a large degree, a common sense of life. I think that in the main, these sympathies and this sense of life were based on the conviction derived from the achievement of Newton that this world was intelligible and hospitable to man. Had this conviction been worked out in the form of a consistent philosophy and spread in the free and open atmosphere of the Enlightenment sense of life, the issue might have been different, and both the clouding over and the ensuing attacks of irrationalism prevented. I think it is still possible to retrace our steps and recover the vision of Joseph Priestley, the co-discoverer of oxygen, with whose words, written in 1771, I now conclude. He's talking about the extension of knowledge. Quote, "Knowledge, as Bacon observed, being power, the human powers will in fact be enlarged. Nature, including both its materials and its laws, will be more at our command. Men will make their situation in this world abundantly more easy and comfortable. They will probably prolong their existence in it and will probably grow daily more happy, each in himself, and more able, and I believe more disposed to communicate happiness to others. Thus, whatever was the beginning of this world, the end will be glorious and paradisaical, beyond what our imaginations can now conceive. Extravagant as some may suppose these views to be, I think I could show them to be fairly suggested by the true theory of human nature. But for the present, I waive this subject, the contemplation of which always makes me happy." Thank you.
George, if you could pull your chair up, I think we need the mic.
Question?
Why did the sense of life of the Enlightenment takes better in America than in the boundary.
Well, in the first place, Newton, the great hero of the Enlightenment, probably didn't have this sense of life himself, as nor did many of his contemporaries. As a matter of fact, Newton was a strange person. We have a letter from him to Locke, accusing Locke of trying to get him into relationships with women. This was not a letter of thanks. It was a letter of paranoid accusation. Many of the initiators of the Enlightenment didn't have a very joyful sense of life. But I think in America, we had a situation in which tradition was less important. Class lines were not as rigid as they were in England. There wasn't the continual struggle against authority. There was the sense of tremendous responsibility in going out and tilling new lands and appropriating them. There was the spirit of the frontier. There was the necessity of greater reliance on reason in order to face nature alone, as in many cases people did. I think, did this at all help?
What about our heritage of Puritanism?
Okay, well, Puritanism was also in England, wasn't it? It was Cromwell. I mean, Puritanism was not something that was unique to the United States, to the colonies, to the British colonies over here. Puritanism did have a so-called work ethic, of course, and that, I'm sure, contributed to some of the spirit in which men attack the job of controlling their environment. But we must remember that Calvin himself was, in his early writing, a disciple of the Stoics and a propagator of the ancient rational, an ancient and rational tradition, and that this was passed on to his disciples, the Puritans, and the Puritans undoubtedly felt that they would best manifest their vocation, their being the elect, by controlling nature and rationally understanding it. And as the development of Puritanism went on, the element of reason became greater and greater. For instance, you have not only Jonathan Edwards in the 18th century as an example of Puritanism, but you also have Jonathan Mayhew, the owner of all of Martha's Vineyard, and a great preacher in Boston, who was probably the strongest adherent of free will during the whole Enlightenment period. And so in Puritanism itself, there was a strong tradition of respect for reason and concern with man's dignity, and so on. It was not just predestinarianism. It was not just original sin. There was a sense of covenant with God, for instance, in which man had the right to ask God to redeem his part of the covenant.
Would you elaborate on the development of the Enlightenment view of man? You mentioned that Locke
Hobbes held a quantitative view of survival. It was survival by hanging by one's fingertips, so to speak, and life was, you remember, nasty, brutish, and short. And the whole object of action in life was to preserve one's the length of one's life, so to speak. Locke had a much more qualitative view of what human life was and what made it worthwhile. And Locke held that man could by himself not just follow stray urges, such as Hobbes seemed to teach, figure out what would be the happiest, the best, the most qualitatively superior sort of life. In other words, it's the quantitative versus the qualitative approach, I think, that's important here on the part of Hobbes on the one hand and Locke on the other. Could you suggest any more?
Well, that seems to be getting more close to the ethics than to human nature. I was struck years ago when I read By his characterization of human nature, I don't remember the text. I remember the conclusion that he seemed to hold that human nature is aimed at competitiveness in the sense of wanting to look better in the eyes of others than others do.
Oh, yes.
The attention to the use of force as a means that man will naturally take against with all the features of, rather, to my mind, the depraved view of human nature, which is what produced the nasty, poor, brutish, and short state of nature. Modern, on the other hand, the normal or average human being works side by side with others, just the problem you mentioned, which caused the need of government. But where is that more benevolent view of man and his needs, man and his natural relationship with all man, come from? What's the background?
Well, first, you jogged my memory into a reminiscence of something that you said many, many years ago, that in Hobbes' view, man was a wild beast locked up in society. And to contrast that with Locke's view, I think it was the inheritance of Aristotle and Aristotle's qualitative concept of what a human life should be. Locke was very much of an Aristotelian in a certain sense. He was a disciple of Hooker. He was a disciple of some of the great legal theorists of the 17th century, like Grotius, for instance. And they, in turn, were disciples of Thomistic and post-Thomistic Aristotelianism. So it should be emphasized that we have here, side by side with Newton, the survival, a strong Aristotelian element in Western European, especially in British thought. I think it was the Aristotelian element. That's what you were... I don't know whether you agree as an Aristotelian scholar.
Yeah, I just don't know the causal chain. Could you say something on Hooker? I mean, you mentioned...
Yeah, Richard Hooker was an Anglican theologian who wrote a famous book called The Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity. And he was highly dependent upon St. Thomas Aquinas, who was dependent on we know whom, Aristotle himself. And there was a strong tradition of Aristotelian scholarship among the clergy of the Anglican Church, who always stressed moderation, for one thing, and the golden mean in spiritual matters. Locke came from this general tradition himself, whereas Hobbes had a much more violent background.
Why do you suppose it was the case that when Newton was buried at Winchester Abbey, gained in church, well, allowed him to be buried there and was so receptive to it?
Well, everybody of considerable importance was buried in Westminster Abbey, unless they specifically requested otherwise. What surprised Voltaire was the contrast between the picture that he had imagined. What would happen in France did they try to bury Newton in Notre Dame?
And that's more to the point. I mean, why was the Anglican Church, did they do it just as a matter of rote, or were they actually allowed to be buried there, or did they actually find sympathy?
Oh, they were in sympathy with him. They were in sympathy with him because they had a more tolerant ecclesiastical structure. They had gone through a period under Cromwell of extreme intolerance, of course. They had experienced further intolerance during the period of the Restoration under James II. It was pretty much of what was at the time called a Whig church back then, when Newton was welcomed with reverence in the funeral. But I didn't mean to emphasize especially the attitude of the clergy, but men. England recognized the greatness of its great men. This is what Voltaire was trying to say. And it was not merely scientists, but it was politicians and clergymen and so forth and so on who gathered there to welcome him. Voltaire, in his letters on the English, which were written to the French, was trying to say, look at the way these English truly appreciate openness of discussion and toleration and so on, as opposed to what we are used to in France, and as opposed to the deal that, imagine Galileo being buried in St. Peter's with honor and respect.
You mentioned Voltaire. Did he have any single large contributions to the Enlightenment, or was it many small things or a certain sense of life?
Well, he was an advocate, fundamentally, of the ideals of the Enlightenment. He was a supporter of the Encyclopedia. He was an advocate of reforms. He strongly attacked some of the terrible miscarriages of law that occurred in France. He tried to mitigate the cruelties of society wherever he could act to do so. He directed the barb of his wit and ridicule against the unenlightened people in society, and this helped a great deal. He even tried to convert the Pope to the Enlightenment by dedicating a play to him, and that Pope was reasonably receptive, and it was Benedict XIV, and he became known for a short time as the Enlightened Pope. But he was fundamentally a publicist, and I think that was his basic contribution. This gentleman. Yes.
I'm mainly interested in the weaknesses in the Enlightenment that led to disintegration.
Yeah.
Would you say that those weaknesses were inherited from the past, or like a poison pill from the past that they accepted and then eventually caused that disintegration? Or would you say that just went off on the wrong way in some respect all by themselves originally?
Well, they were inheritances from the past. For instance, the hedonism was an inheritance from the ancient Epicurean philosophers. The nominalism was an inheritance from people like Hobbes. Most of the concrete content of the inheritance was, most of the concrete content of the failures of the Enlightenment was a matter of inheritance. But there was also the fact that no one really set himself to try to think the whole thing out systematically and be very, very radical and think it down to its roots until it came to Immanuel Kant, who did his job. So I say there was that fact. It's a double factor, really. Yes.
Well, you mentioned one thing, you used significance of concept in 1804 as a sort of ending point. I mentioned that Kant called himself as a rationalist. Isn't significance to some extent outside events, political events, that buried the Enlightenment? Because that was the middle of the Napoleonic Wars, for example, the whole development of, I think it's significant historically that Hegel published the Phenomenology of the Spirit of the Year, Kant dead, D.L.A. had Victor's lectures of the German nation, and that sort of situation, that people, the emotions of the Napoleonic Wars, trooping back and forth across Europe, people let themselves get carried away.
It was the emotions of nationalism and the emotions of religious reaction to the excesses of the French Revolution, conservative reaction, so to speak. Those were important forces. But I think that Kant, you know, cleared the way in a sense by, as to put it in his own words, limiting reason in order to make room for faith, if you remember those words from the preface to the Critique of Pure Reason. By limiting reason, he made room not only for faith, but for whatever else might rush in. Nationalistic fervor, which is after all a form of secular religion, religious reaction such as you've had especially in France, and these first advocates of reaction, I'm thinking particularly of Fichte, proclaimed that they were disciples of Kant. Of course, Kant did not accept that designation so far as Fichte was concerned, as you probably remember. But I do think that the coming of the irrational forces was a very important fact. But I think that the irrational forces might not have had their strength had Kant not done the job of limiting reason beforehand. Because you'll notice that irrationalists of today very often quote Kant as their intellectual grandfather, so to speak. That is to say that Kant showed that reason isn't all, therefore we must listen to X, whatever X may be, faith or the pounding of the Aryan blood or whatever, or the libido or whatever it may be. So I think that the positive forces were the new irrational forces let loose by the Napoleonic Wars and by the French Revolution. But I think a certain negative job was done by Kant in his so-called limitation of reason. This gentleman.
Yes. Did scientists, and I can find the question briefly, have views to how any given theory took dominance over competing theories, sort of along the line of a power qualification theory from Paragon? And if so, did that view have an effect on the view of science that was peculiar to the period?
There wasn't much actual explicit philosophy of science in the sense that you have in Popper or in Kuhn. So there wasn't much talk about the predictive character of science or the kind of models that are discussed today. Now, perhaps you could expand your question a little bit so that I won't give it just a general response. What did you have in mind?
Well, I just wanted to know if they had any theories of the form that Popper advanced, and if they had that theory, then if it had an effect on their view,
namely, that any theory, the statement that any theory in order to be meaningful has to be either verifiable or confirmable or falsifiable, as the case may be.
I'm curious to how one particular theory, let's say Newton's theory of motion, comes to dominate, take precedence over competing theories, which such as Descartes. Was there a widely accepted model among Newton and his colleagues, or was this something that was debated, or something taken for granted?
I don't think they actually knew exactly what they were doing. I think that they just said, look, this theory of Newton really cuts ice. It makes a difference whether it's true or false, and we can conduct experiments on the basis of this theory, whereas we can't go anywhere with Descartes and his physics. But I don't think that anyone ever formulated a general theory as to why Newton's theory cut ice until the late 19th century, when you began to have the scientific positivist movement in its initial phases. I really don't think there's any general discussion anywhere.
Do you think there could have been an alignment without a Newton? And that's rather hypothetical, but you try to think about whether there could be a revival of enlightenment today. It's hard to imagine a scientific discovery on the order of Newton where it might be
Well, it wasn't the details of Newton's theory which brought about the Enlightenment. It was the sudden conviction that the rationality of the universe could be demonstrated. Now, of course, you do have scientific theories today who are committed to the conviction that the irrationality of the universe can be demonstrated. And these theories have had their effect in other areas of life. I think that if not Newton, then someone would have systematized all the laws that I spoke of eventually. It might have been too late. I don't know. Yes.
How did you philosophical trends in the United States, Europe, West today?
In the United States and
the United States and the rest of the world
today. That's too big.
Well, the question might be regarding the Enlightenment topic. When you're talking about a revival, you see signs of a revival, it's so rare, and how it might be fostered or who's fostering it.
Well, my impression is that it's growing more and more irrational. You have a greater relativism. You have, for instance, such things as racial epistemology, feminist epistemology, all sorts of things like this which suggest that people cannot possibly find a common standard to think things out. You have the anti-foundationalism that's so apparent in some of our epistemologies and theories of perception. At the present time, I think that the direction is in the presence of irrationalism. That is, once the fruits of the Enlightenment were there, once the goods were there, so to speak, in the great productive period of capitalist enterprise and invention and scientific invention and so on, came to a close. People tended to revert to more subjective and more tribal values. And now the greatest ambition of people seems to be to reconcile the productivity and the efficiency of the Enlightenment with values which come from some other area, some irrational source, if indeed that is their greatest ambition. Sometimes the ambition is to eliminate man's mastery over nature entirely. Some people go so far as to have that. Yes?
I'd like to you to examine the question of whether two disciplines are by elision passing each other in the night, or when there is a deliberate intent involved. Let me explain what I mean. When Newton projects a universe which is reachable by rational men, that represents an enormous approaches that you outline in terms of an intelligible universe, which is reachable by man of by their thinking. He's in the field of science. Kant, who follows him, and despite popular claims that he is the core, that is, that human is the core, he seemingly is off in a direction as a philosopher in undercutting that sort of intelligibility. Now, as it has been presented by Rand, if I don't slander her, and her disciple, one of these people, namely Kant, is the arch enemy of rationality, not as a disciple of another discipline, that is philosophy, who merely has made a mistake, but sort of as an enemy of rationality, deliberately, in terms of fighting that more optimistic view of life, that Newton. Now, this is the question of two disciplines that by elision never really come to it. In other words, what I'm trying to find out is, how do you perceive motives in to the extent that Kant was anteceded by Newton? Is he a scoundrel in view of the knowledge, or are there just two disciplines that never quite get together? And for good and honest reason, Kant is making his pitch, which undercuts Newton and our pitch.
You mean, do I think that Kant was the worst individual who ever...
Well, that's the way it's been presented, or at least the way I observed it as a attender of these lectures from, objective importance.
Well, first...
First
you mentioned two disciplines. Kant and Newton were essentially in the same discipline, or in various... In physics and astronomy and in science generally, Kant was a scientist. You've got to realize this. And therefore, whatever conflict appeared could not be attributed to the conflict between the two cultures that we talk of today, the humanities versus the sciences. But you've got to realize that Kant was influenced by Rousseau. That's a whole other can of worms that was opened when he read Rousseau. And Kant, in his heart, was afflicted by the conflict between the Newtonian world picture and the Pietist world picture, which he had received from his own culture. He was committed simultaneously to the Newtonian point of view and the Judeo-Christian point of view, but much more intelligently than Newton was ever committed to the Judeo-Christian point of view. Newton, by the way, spent much more time thinking about religion, I think, than Kant did. He spent a great deal of his time trying to calculate the date of the second coming of Christ. So you can't just take a... You've got to realize this is a highly complex picture here. Kant was interested in saving science, saving Newtonian science against the criticisms that Hume made of the concept of the uniformity of nature. And he was interested at the same time in preserving the status of the Judeo-Christian ethic within the Newtonian overall view. He was trying to save the Newtonian overall view from skepticism, and he was trying to save the place of the Judeo-Christian ethic within that Newtonian view. And I think that his philosophy is like a board game. He tried by one move to encompass both of these ends. Now, was he malicious? Was he malicious in doing this? I do not believe so, but I can't be certain. I am much slower in judging people as being malicious than some people are. I think that Kant seized the steering wheel of the Enlightenment, so to speak, and he tried to make it more consistent and at the same time to preserve the values of his Lutheran ancestors. And he drove the bus off the road. That would be my interpretation of it. That's all I can say at the moment. I may give a later lecture on the subject.
Why don't we take one more?
One more. All right, this gentleman down here has been trying to...
You talk
talked about some threats to Enlightenment thinking that are basically on the left today. There are also prominent modern conservative thinkers who talk explicitly about repealing the Enlightenment or reversing the post-Renaissance worldview. I wonder if you could speak to...
I didn't hear that last part.
I recall a quote along the lines of reversing the post-Renaissance worldview. Which I think is the same thing as repealing
yes.
Enlightenment. I wonder if you could speak to what it is that modern conservatives specifically are talking about when they say things like that, and to what extent is it conceivable that such a project could be brought off the air?
You mean what do Bill Buckley and Gary Wills and people like that really have in mind?
Right.
I would say that they have a very bad picture of what would happen if man tried to lead a truly rational life, and that their picture consists in using the Newtonian universe as a means to the most reprehensible of goals, as dictated by original sin and random. However, conservatives tend to think of this. What would happen if there were no laws? What would happen if the branches of government were not balanced against each other? The reason why we need constitutional government, the reason why we need republican government, is because man has original sin. As Ayn Rand said, the alternative seems to be, if man were absolutely innocent, why, this would justify setting up a totalitarianism, which I think is a good observation. Have I answered your question?
Yes. George, thank you.